Yes, so these sessions have been advertised as rambles around pleasure. I hope that was, sufficiently attractive, because, well, most people like pleasure. I will talk about pain for those that like pain, but yes, I am going to concentrate mainly on pleasure. And I'm going to talk about, the place of pleasure in spiritual life, and in a way not just the place of pleasure but the place of feeling in the Buddhist sense of Vedana, but I'm not going to follow that up tonight. Fortunately, I said rambles around pleasure and other themes, so I've got a pretty free hand. But so what I wanted to do was to follow up Tara Hridaya and the things that she was talking about. But there is a link for me. There's a link with the whole issue of pleasure. Just listening to her and watching Tara Hridaya, I realised that I was looking at somebody who is quite fulfilled, and that Tara Hridaya was obviously somebody who was doing something that she strongly believed in, and that therefore gave her a great deal of satisfaction. Even though there were many, many difficulties in the way of it, and even though she's dealing with a lot of suffering, she's doing something she really believes in, and but she feels is making a contribution to the world. And I think that's one of the most important keys to pleasure, to happiness, to satisfaction, to fulfilment. And so hearing her, I was reflecting a little bit on my own experience of working for the Dhamma in general, but working for the Dhamma in India especially. It's wonderful working for the Dhamma wherever you are, but it's especially wonderful where you see the Dhamma change people's lives in absolutely dramatic ways. The story of Tara Hridaya's father is not unusual. I've heard stories of that kind many, many times. Especially with drink. If you've got a very difficult economic situation, if you're socially very deprived, especially for men, drink is an easy way out. It palliates. It deadens the suffering. Of course, it just makes it worse, really. But it gives you the feeling, at least temporarily, of release from it. It's very, very common amongst the so-called Dalits of India, those who would formerly have been considered untouchable. Very, very common indeed, especially the men. And one can sort of understand, one can even sympathise that with a life like that, which gives you so little dignity, so little satisfaction, drink is some sort of release. And of course it's not only in India that happens, it happens all over the world. And what we see again and again and again is that when people encounter the Dhamma, often overnight they'll give up drinking. No special sessions or anything like that. They just discover meaning and purpose in life. And your father's story is not unusual by any means. So I know so many stories of that kind. I know so many situations where, what for me is just, I was going to say a casual presentation of the Dhamma, a fairly ordinary presentation of the Dhamma, changes people's lives. And a lovely story from a very good friend of ours, Jutinda, Dhammachari Jutinda, who came from one of the slums you see there, you saw there in Bopodi, actually, not Dapodi, but in Pune. Very, very rough. His family came from the countryside, and there was a drought. So the whole Dalit part of the village had to go to the towns because there was no water, no food. The caste people in the village, they still had water in their well, but they wouldn't let the Dalits take water from it. They were day labourers for the caste Hindus. And they didn't have any jobs, so they just had to get out and go to Pune and try and find work there. So Jutinda moved into the slums, terrible slums in Pune, and lived quite a rough life. And he became a sort of slum lord. He had a kind of gang, very rough, and they kept a sort of brutal order in the slums, and of course for a payment. And so he was a pretty rough, crude sort of fellow. You can just about see it in him, but it's completely sort of transmuted. You can see occasionally a flash in his eye. But he's a really rough diamond. And one day he was just sort of wandering around in Pune, as one does with his little gang, and he saw a huge crowd. So, you know, he wanted to know what was going on. Maybe there's some opportunity that might present itself to him. So he sort of pushed himself through the crowd, and you can imagine he just shoulder people out the way. He came to a line. It was two lines of women holding candles. And he saw at one end of this line a figure in an orange robe moving down the line, you know, just sort of going through, saluting everybody as he came. This was Bhante Sangharakshita, Urgyen Sangharakshita, our founder. And as he came parallel to Jutinda, Jutinda sort of caught his eye. And Bhante just turned to him and said, "Good." Just good. And then walked on. And Jutinda said that changed his life. So nobody'd ever said good to me before. And he said from then on he knew that he had to live a decent life. And that he could see where that lay. I'm not making them up, they're not fairy stories. Is actually the case that so many people in India live a life without meaning, without purpose, which is just a brutal struggle for survival in an oppressive social situation where they have very little opportunity for escape and growth. And when you work for the Dhamma, you see people just making a huge change in their life. And I know that when I'm, as it were, the agent for the Dhamma, it's not really to do with me. I'm not anything particularly special. But the Dhamma is special. And just a simple presentation of the truths of the Dhamma can transform people's lives in this miraculous way. And Tara Hridaya is a living sort of outcome of that miraculous process. So, yes, I wanted to dwell a little bit on that and then go on to say more. These are rambles, you know, that means that I don't know what I'm going to say until I open my mouth. Yes, I want to sort of ramble a little bit around this theme, first of all, of the importance of meaning and purpose in one's life and how the deepest satisfaction comes from feeling that as much of your life as possible is aligned with a high purpose, a deep purpose, a broad purpose that you feel is worth giving your life to. And I've been very, very fortunate myself that from a quite early age I felt able to do that. I don't know why, but I've been very fortunate indeed to find something that I could put all my energies into. And I think it is the greatest satisfaction that you can find to see that you are doing something that is truthful, it's in line with the way things are, that offers people opportunities that can make their lives meaningful, and that is some sort of contribution to resolving the huge problems that our world faces at the moment. This is something that's been very much on my mind. Everybody's aware of it. Just what a dangerous time we live in. It's not that that people are worse than they've ever been in human history. They're just the same as they've always been. But our unskillfulness, as we would say in Buddhism, our negativity, can have so much more disastrous effect, whether it's our hatred or our greed. As never before in human history, our hatred and our greed, our ignorance, can have a catastrophic effect. They are having a catastrophic effect. You know, the one that's very much before us at the moment is the degradation of the environment and the effect that that's having. I don't need to labour that point. But it's the outcome of our uncontrolled development. But that development is largely sustained by a greed for more and more. The world is also exceptionally dangerous in terms of conflict. We're aware of it, of course, very much in terms of terrorism and the possibility of terrorists getting hold of nuclear weapons, which is pretty inevitable sooner or later, and just the growing intensity and danger of conflict all over the world. So it doesn't take much to realise that there's a very, very dangerous situation indeed. Some people have suggested, and I think there's truth in this, that the world was safer in the Cold War because at least there was sort of, mad, mutually assured destruction. But mad has been replaced by madness, and we don't know who has those weapons and what is going to happen to them. And the tensions that are building up, particularly between... you don't need to go into all the details. I don't need to labour the point. So, these two major factors make the world more dangerous than it's ever been. I don't think there's much doubt about that. I do stress, I don't think it's because it's a worse or the worst people. We're just the same as ever. But the pressure of numbers, the intensity of the interaction between people all over the world and the power of technology makes it much, much more dangerous. At the same time, there's a huge amount of poverty. And that poverty itself is a breeding ground for tension. I'm very much aware of this in India. A lot of people have the idea that India is escaping from poverty. You know, we learn so much about India as an economic tiger, if that's the right expression. Economic elephant, I don't know what. We know some very, very rich Indians. They own half of England, don't they? They even own Brooklyn tea. They own their own tea. They own Jaguar. India owns Jaguar. She owns Jaguar. It's the typically British car maker. It's owned by Tata. We know of India as a sort of growing economic power, and we found, for instance, in Karuna Trust that people are unwilling to give to India because they believe that India's rich. And I've had that said to me. Well, you know, what's the problem? Why are you doing all this work in India? India's rich. But what's happening is that a small section of the population are getting wealthier and wealthier. But overall, poverty is growing. Since the Indian economy was liberalised in 1989 by Rajiv Gandhi, opening up the old command economy, malnutrition has grown in India. Overall, statistics for poverty suggest that it's growing. There was an Indian government statistic the other day that suggests that 70% of the population live in poverty. That's just India. There's Africa, there's huge poverty, the Arab world, there's huge poverty, and all of that is a breeding ground for further tension. I was in India when the attacks took place in Mumbai. I didn't dare breathe much of this in India, but it's so obvious that, if you're a young Muslim, you see what is happening to Islamic countries, and you feel, what can you do? What can you do? You're powerless, so you resort to extreme measures. Interesting enough, Dr. Ambedkar foresaw this, that if India did not sort out Kashmir, the ghost would come back to haunt. The ghost came in November last year. So, yes, there's huge poverty still in the world. Which is a breeding ground for conflict and tension. there's an enormous amount of oppression, prejudice, and so on. So the question for me has always been, well, what relationship do I have to that? What relationship do I have to those problems? You know, I'm the recipient of the benefits of the British history, which is a history which has been benefited from the exploitation of other countries. The British economy it built upon slave labour. It built upon colonialism. So we're the beneficiaries of that of those injustices. I mean, we're not exceptional. Those injustices happen everywhere, but we happen to be quite fat on them, as it were. And so the question comes, what responsibility does one have as a citizen of such a country, enjoying such privileges? And you know, many of you will know this, but I'm travelling between India and Britain. I'm just so aware of the privileges that we have here. You know, like a free health service, which is, we all complain about the NHS, that's what it exists for. It's part of our national complaint department. We all complain about our education system and so forth, but you should see it in India. Like, there is a government free clinic service in India, but you have to pay for it, because the doctors will only work if they're basically bribed. And the provision is not good. It's very difficult for the average Indian citizen to get decent health care. So we are the beneficiaries of hundreds of years of economic and political and social development, which has come at the expense of other parts of the world to some extent. So the question is, what relationship do we as the recipients of that have? What responsibility do we have? I don't think we should feel ourselves guilty, because it was back then, as it were, but we have a responsibility for it. And this has been very much sort of in my awareness from quite early on, partly I think because in the late stages of empire, my father worked in Nigeria, founded the Nigerian Navy, and worked on after independence as well. So I'm sort of aware of the economic and social effects of British colonialism, a very mixed blessing. And it did sort of trouble me even when I was quite small. So, well, I think we can't but be troubled by it. Maybe we try to sort of, we don't know what to do, so we hold it at bay in some way. We push it to one side. But it's there as a sort of niggle, I think, for most people. If you're honest, there in the back of your mind is, well, you know, you don't want to get miserable about it and deprive yourself, as it were. But what are you going to do to try to make sure others enjoy the benefits that you enjoy? Yes, you should enjoy them. But what are you going to do to try and help others to enjoy them? So for me, this was quite an issue all through my university days and so forth. And for me, coming into the Dhamma was as much about what this contributes to the world as it was about what it contributes to me. I needed it. I was, a lost youth of the late 60s, and that meant really lost in a cloud of LSD and so on. Really very much the sort of era when the mould was broken and we just didn't know what we were doing. Thank goodness. So I badly needed some personal sort of direction and some ethical and spiritual direction in my life. And the Dhamma for me was, in the first place, a solution to strong longings and pains that I had myself. But I could not be content if it didn't have some relevance beyond me. And it's principally through going to India. I went first in 1985, and I saw for the first time the Dhamma as a transformative power within society. We've got Tara Hridaya, who's a living example of that. She could not have been here if it wasn't for the Dhamma. I think that's true. I mean, of course, some people have come up from those communities, but it's very unlikely that you would have done. if it wasn't for the Dhamma. So for me, the Dhamma is a way in which one can bring, one can contribute to the solution to these huge problems. I can't solve all these problems myself, but I can make a contribution to them. And my own happiness is tied up with feeling that I am making some contribution to these problems, that I am, at least in my own small way, in company with my brothers and sisters, making some contribution to that. So I want to sort of explore a bit more in what way the Dhamma does contribute to the solution to these problems, seen from the perspective of India, because it's much clearer there. I think it all applies here, but because we live so cushily, by and large, which is an Indian-derived word, by the way, comes from the Indian kushi, which means happy. We live rather pleasant lives, or can live rather pleasant lives, at least objectively speaking. Subjectively is another matter. it's more difficult for us to see the transformative power of the Dharma within even our own society, the potential for its transformative power within our own society. So I want to talk a little bit more, especially because we've seen what Tara Hridaya's got to say about that transformative power. So I want to talk about the main things that people get from the Dhamma. These were very much in Dr. Ambedkar's mind when he converted. He thought of three things especially as the reasons for conversion. So the first thing is that when you become a Buddhist, in a context like India, you escape from an oppressive self-identification and social identification. You are, in India, everybody is identified, unless you the top notch in Delhi or whatever, you're identified through your caste. As soon as you know somebody's name, if you're an Indian, you know their caste. Every Indian learns from birth how to identify the caste of those around them. This is a standing joke I have in talks. You know, I say something like, what happens when two Indians meet? They want to know each other's name. Why do they want to know each other's name? It's not so that they can get to know each other and understand each other better. It's so they can find out their caste. Because the name reveals the caste, at least to some degree. It's not always possible, but there are other ways to tell as well. We're experts. Even I have become an expert. People experience themselves very much according to their caste identity. They experience themselves as belonging within a particular social group, which they know has a particular place in the whole system of graded inequality, as Dr. Ambedkar called it. They know that they're here or they're there. Or they know that they're seen as here or there. And that has a very strong internal effect and a very strong external effect. I'll give you a little example. I was with a friend of mine, a Buddhist friend of mine, which means in this case from a Dalit background. And we were going through, we were flying together. We were going through the security, what do you call it, the X-ray machine. And he got some batteries. So the policeman behind the desk said, well, look, you can't take those batteries. They have to be confiscated. So Maitreya Nagarjun, my friend, was sort of arguing with him and saying, oh, you know, those batteries, they cost me money and so forth. So the man behind the policeman said, in a very friendly way, he said, well, I'm a Vaishya, that means I'm from that trading community, so I understand the value of property, because his caste is a trading caste, so they know... how much is lost, as it were. That, and Maitreya said, well, you know, he's somebody quite self-confident, he's doing a PhD at a top university, he's from a Maharashtrian Buddhist background, so quite confident. He said, immediately I felt my caste. Immediately I felt, how is he going to feel if I say, oh, well, I'm a Dalit. So that's the sort of situation that as soon as people come into contact with each other, caste relations come to the fore. And people identify very strongly with caste. Partly for positive reasons, because the caste is your main Social Security, you know that people will stand with you from that caste. And they're very warm, actually, often, very, very close, you know, in the way that things are close, which means a lot of arguing. A lot of close, warm arguing. Correct? You know, very, very lively, and in a way, very positive community. But only internally. In relation to others, there's tension, there's conflict. Of course, there are also positive relations. But at the back of it all is this sensitivity to where we stand in relation to each other. You know, well, we Brits, we know something about this. You know, about accent, and you can tell by my accent where I come from and all that, wah wah. But you know, it's nothing compared with caste. It's much more deeply ingrained. It's much more strongly ideologically based, even religiously based. So it's a very, very powerful self-determinant. And most people who come from the so-called lower castes will, if internalized, a strong lack of self-confidence and a strong sense of lack of initiative. And those from higher castes will tend to have a strong internalized self-confidence. Again, a bit like class, but magnified hugely, without very much opportunity for movement. Because in the end, caste comes down to marriage. So what matters is marriage within your own community. So, you got it. People identify very strongly with their community. And what becoming a Buddhist does, immediately, is you get rid of that identity, at least for your own purposes. You won't change how other people will see you necessarily. But you stop seeing yourself like that. And you start to see yourself as responsible for yourself. As creating your own life. As having the possibility of creating your own life. One of the curses of India is Kya kuru shakta hoon? What can I do? What can I do? Again, just a little story to illustrate that. I was in Bodh Gaya, and it was taken by some Buddhist communist friends. They don't believe in dialectical materialism, they don't believe in class struggle, but they're still Marxists. Marxists without class struggle or dialectical materialism. Anyway, that's another question. The communists are actually some of the most uncorrupt politicians and the most active working for people in a very genuine way. Anyway, these friends showed me, it's different, I know, worldwide, but they showed me some a work that they were doing. They were collecting people who were homeless, living up in the forests, living out in the wild, living by railway tracks, and they were squatting villages beside the road. And you know, the leader proudly showed me a bullet wound in his shoulder where he'd been shot by the police. He was very pleased with himself. And I said, "Well, weren't you afraid?" And he said, "No, I will go again." And you believe it. And really, very admirable, just really working for other people, actually coming from quite a comfortable background himself. But we got talking to people, and I was asking, "Well, what opportunities do you have for employment?" They said, basically, some day labour every now and again. And they'd be working for maybe 60 rupees a day, which is, what, 80p. A day, and they wouldn't be working every day. So I said, "Well, what are you going to do? What can you do?" And it said, "Kya kuru shakta ho? It is in God's hands." And this is not just a rhetoric; it's a sense that your life is not in your hands. Of course, in a way, life isn't in our hands, but that nothing is in your hands. That you are the victim of forces beyond yourself that you can only propitiate. A lot of popular Indian religion is what I call cosmic corruption. It's basically where you bribe the top officials in the universe, the gods, and you try to get a deal from them to get your job, let you pass an exam, and so on. But basically, it's not in your power. So people will really genuinely think that you know, passing an exam isn't a matter of studying hard. It's a matter of making the right offerings to Ganesh and cheating. And it's because they don't sort of think that it's in my power. So what becoming a Buddhist immediately does is says it's not up to the cosmic authorities, it's not even up to the Delhi authorities or the Bombay authorities, it's up to you. You can create a good life for yourself. Get an education. Live a moral life. Live decently in relation to other people. And you will benefit. And, in 1956, millions of people heard that message, and they did transform their lives. This is statistically verifiable. One main Dalit caste converted in Maharashtra, the so-called Mahars, mainly from that community, which is Dr. Ambedkar's own community. And they heard the message, but there were other parallel communities which were exactly comparable in social and economic terms, which didn't convert, the communities. So you've got a control group, if you like. And what you see is that the those who converted to Buddhism have something like double the educational qualification. literally, 80% against 40%, that sort of thing. They have far more representation in government services. They take advantage of affirmative action to a far higher degree than the non-Buddhists. Because Buddhism tells you it's in your hands. It's up to you. I think it's quite important to realise this. It's not just pious words. It actually affects the way people act. People went home from the conversions, they threw the gods away. They had confidence in Dr. Ambedkar, they had confidence in the Buddha, they had confidence in themselves. For the first time, they felt it was in their hands. And they started to live an active life of self-improvement and social improvement. And that's what you can see. In a way, that's where you've come from, although not from Maharashtra. People who've picked themselves up and made something of their lives. And you'll see they've made huge sacrifices to do it often. Some of you will know Mani Dhamma, is a very good friend of Koteshwar Rao, who I think introduced you to the Dhamma. Mani Dhamma, a lovely Indian man who lived here for some years. I know his father. His father is illiterate. He was a day labourer. Actually, he was a slave, I think you could say, in a village in rural Maharashtra. Really, effectively a slave. But he heard Dr. Ambedkar's message. He understood that he must get his children education. And he and his wife struggled to provide the circumstances for their children to get an education. And Mani Dhamma said he realised in retrospect that his father and mother sometimes did not eat, so that their children could have enough to go to school and learn. So people made those sort of sacrifices. They had that sort of confidence that it was up to them. And Mani Dhamma's brother became a collector, which is, I think you could say it's God in a locality. Over probably 500,000 people, he had huge powers. So as a result of becoming a Buddhist, taking life on himself, just in an ordinary, as it were, practical way, lifting himself up, making something of his life, and therefore providing not only for himself, his family, and his community. So that's the first effect of conversion, that you come to a correct understanding of who you are. You're a human being, equal to anybody else, at least in equal value, whatever society may think, whatever others may say, you feel that yourself, that you have a responsibility for yourself, which you can exercise, and that you have a duty to live a good life, an ethical life. And huge changes take place. So as we're going around India, we're talking to people about the Dhamma. This is the first message they will get. They will get the message that we are human beings. Whatever caste we belong to, we're human beings. Our life is in our hands. We can change ourselves. The second message is that, and this is a very important one from Dr. Ambedkar, that a just society, a free society, rests ultimately upon the attitudes of society's members. A free and just society can't be enforced by the law. The law can only tidy up around the edges, as it were. The law can only sort out the recalcitrant minority, if you see what I mean. The majority of people determine the equity of the society, the equality of the society, the justice of the society. So, if you want a free and just society, it has to be based upon ethical principles. But ethical principles have to rest upon a view of human life, of human existence, a view of what life is for, why we are here, what we are doing here. And I think this is Dr. Ambedkar's really great insight, which is applicable not just in India, but everywhere. I think I said this here just a few months ago. In Britain today, we're coasting on the remnants of a Christian ethics, which everybody would have had, which had its beneficial dimensions. But we're coasting on it. How long can we coast on that without it being replaced by some new ethical perspective? And in India, society is governed by principles that are fundamentally unethical. Principles, of course, there are ethical people, many of them, but the predominant mood within society is of inequality, inequality being, as it were, cosmically justified, because caste is justified by a religious system, as it were. So Dr. Ambedkar said, we need a new perspective on what life is, so that ethics, the relations that we have between each other, are sustained. Good relations between each other rest upon a perspective on human life that is very different to the one that has prevailed in India up until now, at least for most people. So he said that if Indian society is to change, then a new ethics needs to come into existence. And that new ethics he saw as ultimately being best based upon the Dhamma. Partly because the Dhamma is an Indian religion, and therefore is still traceable in Indian society. You can still see it in Indian culture. The Buddhism has survived under the surface in Indian society. Some of the best features of Indian society come from Buddhism, which of course died out effectively 1,000 years ago. So he said that it's in Buddhism that those ethical principles that can be found, which are in tune with the modern mood, with modern society, that are reasonable and not against reason, that are equitable, that are in tune with modern perspective of social justice, and that provide a basis for good relations between citizens. So this is the second aspect of conversion. Once people convert, they get a new vision of human society. They move away from a vision of human society which is inequitable, that's based on caste, that's based on injustice, and they move to a perspective on human society that is based on good relations between citizens, based ultimately on Maitri, he said, that a good society is based on respect for one citizen for another. So for him, conversion to Buddhism meant a movement towards a vision of human life that provided a basis for a good society. That's the second thing that people get. They begin to believe that society could be different. They begin to see how it could be different. They begin to work to create a different society by trying to get this perspective of the Dhamma across to more and more people. Finally, Dr. Ambedkar taught, and it's something that we see, that human life is ultimately about the cultivation of the mind. It's about the cultivation of the powers that we have within us. As human beings, we have capacities way beyond what we presently experience. We're capable of experiencing things in a much richer, much fuller way, and of experiencing much greater happiness, much greater fulfillment. And human life, human society, is ultimately about all of us developing ourselves to the highest possible degree, which in Buddhism, of course, is represented by Buddhahood itself. So again, we see people coming from the poorest backgrounds finding the possibility of self-development, self-improvement, lifting themselves up in not merely in a social way or an economic way, educational way, not merely in an ethical way, but lifting themselves up by cultivating the possibilities of the human mind. So we would find, we saw pictures of it there. You saw pictures of women gathering for meditation class. Some of those will be slum women, who are living very, very poor lives, who may be facing a lot of difficulties at home. I think something like 60% of Indian women, according to surveys, report they've experienced domestic violence at some point in their lives. It's a huge proportion. So many of those women will have experienced that. Many of them will experience a lot of opposition from their family, out of love actually. They don't want them to suffer by being in danger, but they restrict them. So they come along, they'll learn to meditate. They'll learn to develop their minds. They'll learn to cultivate states of extreme, intense positivity, of Maitri. They'll learn to develop states of very strong concentration. They'll develop some insight into the way that life really is, even though they may be illiterate even. I've seen people who are illiterate, drinking the Dhamma like thirsty men and women. They're just taking it in and really deeply understanding it, although they can hardly explain anything about it. It's not a matter of education. So what we find is that when people come across the Dhamma, they change their attitudes to themselves. We find that they gain a new confidence that there can be a just society. If enough people take on the Dhamma, there can be a just society. And finding some higher possibility for themselves, discovering within themselves potentialities they'd not even dreamed of before. And it's just the most wonderful thing you can do to communicate to people, such a simple message which costs you nothing to communicate the basic principles of the Dhamma. You know, it's not anything very clever on my part to communicate them. But people just lap them up. They love what they hear and it transforms their lives. Now, I've talked about it in terms of India, and it's so obvious in India. You see the transformation taking place there, and it's so obvious. You see miracles happening. You know, we had a retreat for 5,000 people I talked about earlier, which Tara Hridaya was one of the leading leaders of. And we saw a huge impact on so many people, just going away, changed in their perspective on life, and going back wherever they came from with renewed confidence and vigour, a new vision. So yes, it's very, very rewarding to work like that in India. But actually, it's the same here. It's just not quite so obvious. It's a smaller audience. You know, we're all very excited because the shrine room is packed. For Tara Hridaya, this is, you know, a disappointing evening. I'm only too I'm joking, but you know what I mean. You'd sort of expect many more people at an average class than this. But you see people's lives transformed. Our lives have been transformed. My life has been transformed. And the same issues arise here. We don't have an entirely just and free society. We have a society that's very comfortable, but most of our comfort is based upon a historical exploitation and even a present exploitation. We're enjoying the privileges that we have. Well, for instance, the whole question about pollution, isn't there? The developed nations are trying to get India and China to pollute less. We've done all the polluting. Now we want them to stop when they haven't even come out of basic poverty. So we live on the basis of an inequity. And we consume far too much. You know, what's, I said this last time, didn't I? What's the solution to the crisis that we're facing, the credit crisis that we're facing, that our august leaders from all over the world came together, they came up with a solution. The solution was, we should all shop. That's the solution to the economic problems of the world. We should all go shopping. It's literally true. Absolutely literally true. That's what they want us all to do, to go shopping. It's crazy. It can't go on. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, really we have to reduce our needs. We have to be satisfied with less. We have to live a life that is fulfilling and satisfying with much less in the way of material goods. So, you know, there are quite strong ethical issues in our consumption, even. Our consumer society is in a sense, unethical because of the consequences it's having geopolitically and the consequences it's having environmentally. So these ethical issues are right in front of us. The policies of our government contribute to polarisation and poverty worldwide. So we need to play a part in changing that. We need to reach out to people who are at the other end of the benefits that we enjoy. So it seems to me that very large ethical issues confront us in this society. And those ethical issues are best dealt with through something like the Dhamma. For me, it is the Dhamma. Through living ethically, through finding satisfaction much more deeply within the mind, much less in consumption, and through a real understanding of what life is. We need to promote these ideas very widely within our society so that there's a radical change in the way that people relate to each other, the way they live their lives, and the way that our politics unfolds. We need to promote these ideas here just as much as in India. It's not so obvious because, you know, we're comfortable. Even, you know, a crisis means just a sort of a lowered consumption, as it were, temporarily lowered consumption. In India, a change in to the Dhamma means a radically new life. For us, it doesn't represent that in quite the same way. But actually, it's before us too. These same issues, in different ways, work all over the world. So I would suggest, and this is my closing remark because it's getting late, I'd suggest that if you want to live a happy life, if you want to live a satisfied life, you need to feel that you're contributing to the solution of these problems. You can do that by supporting Tara Hridaya. She'll do it for you. But it's not enough. I'm sorry, it's not enough. It's wonderful, but it's not enough. We have to be doing it here too. The ideas that are embodied in the Dhamma are, to my mind, the best solution in front of us in the current era to the problems that the world faces. And these ideas have to be lived, that's our responsibility, and they have to be communicated. And I think if we can put ourselves fully behind that task, we can feel a great deal of satisfaction. We won't solve everything ourselves. It's not just up to us. It's up to us working together and with many other people of goodwill. But I hope that you can be inspired by what Tara Hridaya does, to help her and to contribute to what she's doing, but also to think that you can do the same here. In different ways, but you can do the same here. You can contribute to changing the fundamental ethical basis, the fundamental basis of vision in our society here in Britain and wherever else anybody may come from, because a change is desperately needed. So, there you are. I've sort of roughly rambled around pleasure. I'll get much more close and personal tomorrow. We'll be really talking about pleasure and pain tomorrow. I won't say I'll make you suffer or bring you bliss, but I'll at least help you, I hope, to understand a bit more clearly why it's important to find sources of pleasure in your life and for those to be supportive of your spiritual endeavours. And I'd suggest don't forget what I've said tonight, that the most important, the most fundamental sort of satisfaction for us as human beings comes from a noble purpose that we feel we can put ourselves behind without equivocation, without ambiguity, and that we feel is really contributing both to our own benefit and to the benefit of the world. So I'll leave you there. Come back, please, if you want pleasure and a little bit of pain, if you're interested in it. And we'll ramble further around pleasure.